Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined today by Peter Milliman, the newly named head coach at Johns Hopkins University, having shepherded the Cornell Big Red for 2.5 seasons and developing an impressive record. And I'm also joined by IL Editor-in-Chief Matt Kinnear, as we are going to tag team this interview. So first things first, Coach Milliman, thank you so much for joining us. How are you handling quarantine?
Thanks for having me. Quarantine is treating me well. I'm hoping in the same category as most everybody else. There are some new challenges and there are some new ones every day, but I am getting to spend a lot of family time and finding a way to try and run a program from my basement and doing the best I can with it, but doing well so far. Appreciate that.
Coach, it's it's been just about a few weeks here since you were hired as the head coach at Johns Hopkins. We got to talk to you a little bit in your kind of presentation meeting with the media, a few days after that. But if you could just kind of put into context this opportunity and what it means to be the head coach of a university like Johns Hopkins.
It's extraordinary as a professional opportunity for someone that does this for a living. I mean, you get a chance to be a coach at this caliber, coach young men like this, be part of the university. That's it's such an extraordinary place. I'm excited about it. I know there's a lot of challenges that come with it. There's going to be some tough road ahead of us for sure, and it's a really competitive environment. But this is an opportunity that you you relish to have if you're a coach. This is what you want to do for a living.
So in that introductory press conference that Matt mentioned, we talked a little bit about the unique nature of this search, given the fact that it occurred during a global pandemic and there were limitations both on communication, visiting, all that sort of thing. But for you, I'm interested in, kind of putting the prior couple of weeks and months into context. I recently rewatched your game against Ohio State, and it brought back this flood of emotion where it was just like one of those things where I was thinking about, man, first of all, we lost the season, and second of all, we have all these unanswered questions. When you reflect on this 2020 campaign with your Cornell team and then think about it in the context of the foundation for this move for you professionally, how do you think about that? How do you think about what the month of March was like?
That's an interesting question. It's really hard to put into context what my experience as a whole at Cornell meant to me, and then really what this season was. I mean, this was I think a good year in the making, but I think we really just started to feel like the guys that were involved in the program, the guys on the team, the guys have been putting in the work for a long time, started to really feel like we're moving forward with some solid footing. I mean, we had some ups and some downs for sure in the last couple of years, but we were really starting to feel like it was coming together the right way. The team was competing, the leadership was there, and we were excited about it. So there was certainly a disappointment, and you don't want to overvalue your disappointment as opposed to other people's because you thought you might have had a great season coming or something like that. So it's it's a reality check in all ways, but it really they're just two separate stories to me. That the season that I had at Cornell this year and my time there, and then where I'm at now. I mean, everything that I'm doing right now is a part of what I learned and I experienced and I grew from at Cornell. But I'm not really sure if I'd be able to put a direct connection to how those one led to the other than the obvious coaching experience year to year.
Coach, and as you're looking forward and you're kind of straddling this these two different links of your career now. How do you kind of close the chapter of your Cornell and say your goodbyes to those guys and tie up your loose ends while looking forward and moving forward as Johns Hopkins head lacrosse coach?
That part's hard. It was really hard at first. I was working to transition out, and my guys are seeing me do a press conference with a new shirt on and a different sound in my voice. Before it had to have the ability to have a conversation connection with each of them and talk to them personally and their families and tell them, you know, how much I appreciated my time with them and everything that they did and you know, in their time at Cornell and for my career. But, you know, right now I'm still living in Ithaca, New York. We're working on moving down there, but without an immediate time frame and with two young girls at home, we're going to take advantage of every opportunity we have to not be rushed and to not, you know, jump right into this. I mean, a normal time frame would have probably had us, you know, moving down into temporary housing or finding an apartment in a couple of weeks and, or me going down there and leaving my family here, something crazy. But, you know, right now, at least we have a couple months before it's necessary. Right now, I would still be working from home if I lived in Baltimore. So just in that regard, you know, giving myself the opportunity to, make sure I close things out the right way up here, but it's been a little bit challenging to gain some traction and feel like I really have a handle on a lot of things at Johns Hopkins because I'm, you know, putting together a staff over the phone and not meeting in person. I haven't really been in my office or, you know, I had a computer mailed to me a couple weeks ago. My staff is still, you know, just got email addresses yesterday. And so there's just a lot of things that just take a little bit of time to work through and, you know, that they have to go in order and it's just not right to feel like you're going to jump too far ahead and start, you know, recruiting before I know the guys, you know, on the roster, so to speak.
You mentioned your staff and the, you know, certainly a lot of interest, a lot of excitement around bringing in Jameson Kesterer from UMBC, a Hopkins alum, one of the more highly regarded young defensive coordinators. And then John Grant Jr., who had spent two seasons at Air Force, had one of the most illustrious playing careers in lacrosse history. And to me, it's hard to imagine a better outcome for a guy in your position to step into this job and immediately inject so much excitement into the program and into the alumni and candidly into the world of lacrosse by virtue of making these decisions. What was the thought process and how did the actual process of getting those guys to join your staff unfold?
Well, I can assure you that the design of that was not to inject excitement as much as it was to get the best people for the job. And that was the beginning and the end of that strategy was, you know, where do I go find the best coaches that I can find to work with, to bring together, to challenge these guys, to develop a program and, you know, an identity that, you know, for the next few years is going to be, you know, it's intended to compete with everybody in the country, the top teams in the country. We want to put something together that's going to be, you know, respected by everybody that's ever, you know, been a fan and appreciated Johns Hopkins lacrosse. I mean, this is a unique opportunity for that reason. And, you know, I needed guys that would understand that, guys that would have the capability of coaching at a high level, but also leading and recruiting at a high level. And, you know, not, you can't just go by resumes. You can't just go by recommendations. I mean, you have to actually, you know, get to know guys, do the diligence to dig up some information. And, you know, Jameson Kesterer really jumped, right off the page at me. I mean, I had a group of really, really high level, coordinators that I was lucky enough, to talk to. And I thought that I would have been in great shape getting any of them. And I was really, you know, I don't want to say I was starting to get complacent, but I was starting to really feel like, you know, wow, I could really not get this one wrong. And, you know, the more I talked through it, Jameson just seemed to continue to step forward because of, you know, what his experience has led to and really what his mentality and what his drive is about. You know, he wants to be a head coach. He wants to be a high level coordinator, but he also wants to be a leader. You know, he wants to be, you know, somebody that can help these guys in their lives, you know, understand what it's all about and not just so that they, you know, can be in great defensive position all the time, but so that they can understand, you know, how important everything they do on campus and how they represent the program and, you know, what it means to be a Johns Hopkins lacrosse player. And so, you know, everything about him was really, you know, just A+ from the beginning. And I was excited because I had never met him before that first phone call. It was an introduction and an interview at the same time. So that was great. Juniors was a bit different because I've known him for a long, long time. We've been, you know, friends. We've, you know, played together. We've played against. We just a you know, a friend of mine that I knew, you know, over the last few years had been getting more and more serious about this direction in his career, this new step. And I've been lucky enough to interact with him on the coaching side and work with him a little bit and see him coach and just, you know, realize that, you know, my impression of him as a player, I was now, you know, putting that in the past and starting to look at him as a coach and realizing how talented he is and how much he really has to offer. And I think, you know, the biggest hurdle for him in his coaching career has been that he was so good as a player, he didn't have the opportunity to start coaching a lot longer. So he kind of began this later on and has had to struggle through some things as well. You know, he's coaching high school and he got a job at Air Force and really had to do some great things there. But, you know, when I made the decision on each of them, I like the glow went across my face. Like, you know, if I really get a chance to get this guy, it's gonna be great. And, it happened both times. And, you know, I really just in the short time we've been together, I already feel like it's a unique, you know, opportunity for us going forward.
Pete, now that you've made these hires, how, you know, just kind of with the challenges that we're facing, how do you guys meet? How do you guys, you know, kind of get your action plan going under the circumstances of, you know, you're living in three different parts of the country right now, and you're doing everything remotely and through Zoom calls, I'm assuming. How do you just make that work?
You know, it's a lot of logistics are at play in everything we do. I mean, I've done already like three or four different formats of video conferencing and, you know, different types of conference calls. And so it's a collaborative effort and really just trying to figure out what we all think we can do to make some progress right now, because everybody's got ideas, but we're not sitting in an office with a big board in front of us and we can start to map out what we're doing. And, you know, everybody's got a different schedule. Junior's 2 hours behind us time-wise. You know, we're all dealing with them. Like I said, they haven't had computers or emails, you know, set up for them yet. And so, we're just trying to make the most of it, make sense of it, you know, not trying to get too far ahead of ourselves. Cause this is a daunting task. There's a lot of work, that goes into this. And, you know, putting the staff together was a big early priority, and getting to know the team, starting to set some standards and make sure that we're all on the same page as a group. We're doing a daily Zoom conference as a staff just to kind of get, you know, run through some things, see each other's face, make sure we're talking about things and getting organized. But, you know, we'll start to develop a little bit more of a steady routine when we, you know, the workflow starts to go back and forth. We're just setting up, you know, our Google Docs and our calendars and things like that. And so it's great because you like after all the chaos and the hecticness, just to feel like you start putting it, you know, in order, that you're getting excited to do stuff again. You know, the kind of the stagnation of the quarantine at the end of the season, and you just start to, you know, spin your wheels a little bit. I think this, you know, gave us a good burst of energy and excitement about something pretty quickly. And so it, you know, it's really felt good to be working my butt off, you know, doing this stuff. But, you know, it's hectic, man. It's tough. There's a lot of challenges that we don't even understand that we're dealing with on a regular basis. So, you know, just trying to work together and figure these things out as we go.
You mentioned trying to get to know the current roster. I've talked to coaches in mm-hmm. your position that take new jobs and some, you know, kind of have different philosophies, particularly around familiarizing yourself with personnel by watching prior year's film. So did you watch this, you know, 2020 season's Hopkins film, or have you? And what are the other things that you're trying to do in order to familiarize yourself with the guys on the team?
I've watched some of it. I know Jamison and Junior, I've watched a bit. But you know, what we started to do, we just had actually earlier today, we had a support staff call. So we had, strength coach, academic advisor, athletic training staff, compliance, sports information, pretty much looped in everybody that surrounds the program and works with them on a consistent basis. And we were able to run down, top to bottom from the roster, you know, everybody that they've worked with over the last few years, who we are still just kind of getting started with. And we were able to get some more background information, you know, how is he done with his fitness? Where is this kid in the weight room? What's he working on? What type of things are his struggles? You know, is anybody, you know, in an academic situation that we need to be more aware of than others, or, you know, who's got a harder program, or who's challenging themselves the most. So we really were able to start mapping out, you know, what can help us build essentially a profile on each guy so that when I get to meet him, I don't have to start from square one from like the face-to-face or the phone calls or things like that. And even so much as going backwards, because some of the, you know, there were freshmen who were only really, you know, through a fall and then just the very first part of their first, you know, spring season. So a lot of that information isn't really, you know, hard, reliable data for a lot of those guys. So we're spending time essentially recruiting conversations as you would kind of going back with high school coaches, club coaches, just getting some more depth. There's a lot of the guys in the incoming recruiting class, the 2020 class, that I don't know that well. Some of them I do. There's a kid from my same high school, so I know a bit more about him. There's kids on this in this class that I recruited, some that I, you know, recruited on the roster, so I know their parents. But, you know, doing whatever we can to just build some you know, information about the guys that help us, you know, coach them and help us, you know, design a game plan or a strategy, you know, going forward. And then, you know, from there, you know, we had a senior. I kind of just lumping the fifth years in there too, but the seniors and the fifth year guys, we had a conference call last night, a Zoom call, and, you know, started talking about, you know, our identity and, you know, what is Hopkins Lacrosse and how do you guys see where we were at, and, you know, allowing those guys to have a voice and inform me, but also let them get to know me and my staff a bit better and hear our voice and what we want to do. So a lot of it is really kind of gathering information, but it's not unlike what you would be doing if, you know, if we were in the office or if we were even on campus and in season. You know, you're just starting to generate a working knowledge of, you know, who you're with.
You know, that question, what is Hopkins Lacrosse, I think is the core at a lot of things. And, you know, this is a job that had a lot of attention. It had a lot of alumni interest. You know, I know Cornell has a very significant alumni base who's really invested in the program, but, you know, there might not be a group of alums who are more interested in the success of their program as Johns Hopkins. And, you know, as you're kind of getting, I'm sure you're getting a lot of, you know, opinions of what is Hopkins Lacrosse thrown your way. What have you started to maybe formulate in your mind of, you know, what represents Johns Hopkins Lacrosse?
You know, it's the premier program in college lacrosse. This is the most storied tradition, the most successful history. This is, there's a reason that there's this much attention and that this much eyes around the program, because they have been very successful. They've been highly competitive for a long, long time, and they've got some really, really supportive alums. You know, the opinions and the scrutiny that I think, you know, carry a negative reference when a lot of people talk about it are not things that I've experienced as much. And I'm not, you know, going to dismiss that I won't. I have felt an overwhelming, you know, presence of support and positivity from the group, from the alums, from the administration, from the team, just in general. I mean, they want to be successful. I think, you know, because you get to be a part of a storied program like this, obviously it brings with it expectation, but it also brings with it opportunity and privilege to be, you know, with other young men like this, to be led by, you know, some alums and some, you know, a coaching staff that is, you know, is established as you know, these my assistant coaches and guys that have you know, been around successful places. And you know, this is something that you know, guys appreciate, they respect, and that's what I'm getting, is that the real genuine investment from people to do what it takes to be successful, not just the demands to, you know, figure it out or find a way. Hey, you know, I've had more questions. What does it take? What do you need? How can we help you be successful? And that's, you know, it's not an isolated scenario, but it's a unique environment to be in something like that.
To the degree that you called Johns Hopkins the premier program in lacrosse, during this search in the wake of Dave Petromala's departure, talked to some of your head coaching peers, and there was a handful of different perspectives, but not uncommon theme was, you know, they're ill-suited to be in the Big Ten, the ability to compete with these big football schools and all the resources that they have available. Some other head coaches were trying to paint the picture that Johns Hopkins was not the premium job. And I don't accept that. I reject that notion. I think that, you know, between having a $10 million lacrosse-only facility, having an unbelievable ESPNU exposure to building a really strong schedule through the Big Ten and play your road games on BTN, and then chiefly the opportunity to offer an education and a degree at one of the world's foremost institutions in the sport of lacrosse, it stands out. And obviously you agree. But how did you come to those types of conclusions when you were assessing whether or not this was the move that you wanted to take? Because certainly you left a program that has a lot to speak for it as well. It's easy to imagine a guy saying, you know, Hopkins is interesting, but I'm good to stay at Cornell. And so when you stacked everything up, what were the attributes of the program that compelled you to make this choice?
Well, you know, I think the first thing that I would just say is that as much as this is a decision that, you know, I felt strongly about and was excited about, this isn't, you know, an isolated opinion of, you know, I want to go coach at Johns Hopkins and I want to move from here. You know, I am almost 50% of this decision with my wife. And for us as a family, it was very clear that this was the right step forward for us. We felt that for us being down closer to where my wife can compete and find an opportunity to coach in a club level and be closer to her family and just different opportunities, it just really felt like it was the right fit. And if I didn't think that Johns Hopkins was the right move for me professionally and as a job, we wouldn't have made it, and vice versa. If it wasn't for our family, you know, I wouldn't have done it even if I thought this job was great. But, you know, when I began the process, the interview process, I probably was very similar to a lot of the other skeptics, a lot of the other opinions around the country that, you know, it might be good, but you're competing against the Big Ten, and, you know, there's a lot of other, you know, factors that are challenging, high academic standards, and, you know, I get all those things. I completely understand them, but I don't agree with very many of them. And some of the information that I learned through this process, some of the experiences I had with people around the program, the leadership, the institution, it made it very clear to me that this is as winnable and supportive and progressive of a program as there possibly could be. And I don't think you need a $10 million facility, not that we don't have one. I don't think you need to play in a 100,000 seat stadium to feel like you're a big time program. I mean, we have as much TV exposure and opportunity to, you know, compete as anybody in the country. And so really, I don't know if I found a whole lot of those examples as valid. I didn't really understand them, to be honest with you. I think, you know, Johns Hopkins is a premier institution. It's one of the finest academic institutions in the world. So you can find young men who want to be, you know, successful well after college, who want to be doctors and lawyers and bankers and anything that they want to do. You know, they can study at Johns Hopkins and get a premier level education. I also can bring guys in who are driven to be successful, who are hardworking, who are committed to something, not just because they're talented, not just because they have ability to score goals or play defense or whatnot, because they're successful young men, sometimes unique young men who don't compare to a lot of other guys. Again, not because of their talent, but because of their maturity level, because of their drive, their competitiveness. Those are the young men that we're looking for. That's what's going to make a successful program more than a collection of good lacrosse players. And I believe that firmly, that they had to meet the people at Hopkins and learn more about the institution. I realized that the vision that I had in my head and the vision that the university had for their lacrosse program were aligning. And that's what made it really interesting to me, that I almost had like a dawning of this idea when I was like, this is not what people think. Like, you can really win here. You can really win here. There's no doubt in my mind. And I don't know if you know, it needs to be explained to other people. And honestly, I'm not really that concerned with whether people believe it or not, because I'm comfortable and confident in it. And I believe that the guys on the team are as well. And I know that the support around the program and the administration believe that.
Pete, we talked a bit before about just, you know, your kind of history with coaching and your background. And, you know, it's not traditional. And you know, from everything that I read in conversations with you, you're proud of the way you've worked through the coaching ranks. You know, I was talking to one of your buddies who said, you're a guy who dives right in when given an opportunity. That was the way he kind of described you, dives right in with both feet. How does that, you know, your time coaching in D2, coming out of the D3 ranks and kind of working your way from volunteer through all the different coaching levels, how has that forged you for this?
You know, the first thing I would say is that, you know, your comment to begin this question was that it seems like a non-traditional pathway. And the really unique part about this is that it's the most traditional pathway that there is. I don't think there's the majority of coaches who graduate as high-level players from Division I institutions and just start bouncing around, to get great jobs because they already understand where they can compete at a high level because they have name recognition, so people will know them, or they're obviously talented young men, and so you know you give them a chance to grow and to work under you. I mean, I just did it. It's a job I was at. I hired two Cornell alums who were really successful guys, really highly rated, players who had the ability to go off and do whatever they wanted. They're both business school kids. I mean, and I was pretty open with them. I'm like, this is almost going against my belief that I would hire you guys, because I believe that it's part of my responsibility to make sure I give consideration to people who work their way through this business, who commit to it. And because I knew them so well, because I trusted them, I believe that they were the right fit, and I still believe that. I think they're phenomenal young men, and I think I got very lucky to be able to work with them. But that's also, like, to me, that's unique. To me, that's maybe there's more of it in Division I, but there's far more Division II and Division III coaches and Division I assistants who are not, high-level players or Division I grads. And so I think if you're looking at a sampling of all the college coaches in the country, most of them have a path that's more similar to mine. And I just don't know if it gets as much, notoriety, because most of those guys are looking to coach. They're looking to compete, not necessarily to get to the highest level or to get to Division I or to be the head coach at Hopkins. And I thought it was, to find a place where I was, happy and I was comfortable with my life. And that allowed me the opportunity to coach and really, fulfill my passion. But, maybe similar to the comment you made, like that kind of passed by pretty quickly when I realized that I just don't have the drive for coaching at that level. I just wanted to keep finding another challenge. And when I had an opportunity to make a jump to the coaching Division I, I felt like I wanted to do it. It's not like it was because I wanted to be better or prove that I could do more. I think I just wanted to coach at that level because I wanted to coach those young men. I know some of the best coaches I know in the sport coach at Division II, Division III, and even high school. And it doesn't mean that they didn't take chances. It doesn't mean that they're not as good at coaches. It just means that's what fit them for where they are in their lives. And I think that's great. But the opportunity for me presented itself when I was 34 years old to take a volunteer role at Princeton. And that was before I met my wife and before I had my kids. If that opportunity presented itself today, I wouldn't be able to take it, but I could at that time. So it was one that I felt that I should. I don't think everybody else needs to do that in order to find success at this level, but if I didn't do it, maybe I would still be coached Division II or Division III. I have no idea.
Those experiences that you had at Pfeiffer and that kind of leap to Princeton, where I know you had to kind of take a volunteer job, that just seems like you touched on it a little bit, but it seems certainly like an important moment and kind of a crossroads of your career. I'm curious who you maybe talked to at that point of, going through your decision-making process of your career. Who were some of those peers and mentors who maybe helped you along with those decisions?
That's a good question. I called Coach Janzik, who has been a longtime mentor of mine and will always be my coach. I called, I think, Jamie Steele, who I've known for a long time. Gina Peluso, who's at Stevens, I've known for a long time. He actually was my JV lacrosse coach in ninth grade. I talked to my athletic director where I was at Pfeiffer, who believed strongly that, I would be successful if I really, took a chance. So I talked to my family. I talked to a couple friends who I needed to discuss the logistics with. I had a friend that lived in New Jersey who had a wife and two little kids, and he's like, somebody I grew up with, like, if you really want to do this, I think you need to do this. He's like, I'm not going to let you not do this because you think that it's too hard, that there's not a way to make it work. He's like, do you want to stay at my place for a little bit or whatever you're going to do? And because I had friends that believed in me and friends that felt that they would help me out with things when I needed to. And it's tough when you're 34 years old to feel like it's a responsible thing to do. But again, I was single at the time and felt like if I was going to take the chance, it might as well be then before I, considered doing it later on in life where it wasn't possible. And so, I didn't feel like it was as risky as maybe people thought it was, because there is enough with the growth of lacrosse, there's enough opportunity to keep working and pay your bills. Just, you know, working events and coaching some teams and running some, you know, shooting clinics and whatever you can. I mean, you can string together some paychecks to help yourself out with those things. And that's, again, that's something I believe in. I don't think that can display like anybody's, lower level ability by any means. It proves their worth and their strength by pushing through those things.
You know, I talked to Sean Wilkins and he, I know you guys are close, and he told me a story about you're driving.
I remember talking to Wilkins about that too. Actually, he thought I was crazy when I said I was going to do it, but he was like, "You're really going to leave for a volunteer job?" I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "That's nuts." And then as soon as I did it, he was like, "You're right. That's a better idea because Princeton's good."
Yeah, he told me about a story of you were driving up from Pfeiffer up north, and him and Grant were running a camp in somewhere in Virginia. The way he related is like you just talked to him on the phone and ended up staying at the camp for a few days. Can you explain this one to me?
This is a great one. I was on my way. So I lived in North Carolina when I was at Pfeiffer, but being from Rochester and I had a lot of friends there, it was my biggest advantage in recruiting is that I would just go home. I would go back and I'd stay with my friends. I'd stay with my family so that I could recruit back in upstate New York, as opposed to traveling around down in the South or having to actually travel around without a recruiting budget, because there's no budget. So I was on my way home. I was just going to go home and watch some tournaments, stay in Rochester for a little while. I called Sean while I was driving, and he said he was running this camp with Junior in Virginia. And so I looked it up where it was, and it was like the next exit. And so I ended up just deciding to go there, and I recruited that thing for a couple of days instead of driving up north. But I continued on my path. On my way, I felt like there was a recruiting opportunity that was close enough, and my friends were there, so I was able to enjoy my recruiting experience while I was doing it.
You know, and that to me speaks a little bit about, the way he described it is like you were just jumping in there and coaching the kids. And, one of the things that talking to Hank Jancic about you and your career is just, you know, he described it like you just love the game. You know, that's as simply as he could put it is, you love the game. You love everything about the game, playing it, coaching it, studying it. Where does that love come from to you? And you know, how has it, you know, maybe not changed over the years as it's become your career. It's a passion, but it's also a career. How do you still love the game so much?
You know, one of the first things I think that is so apparent to me about this, and it is definitely one of the first things that I fell in love with about lacrosse, is the integrity of the game and the history. It's a sport that has a real, connection to where we are, to North America, to upstate New York, to Native American culture. You know, it made me feel like a better person when I learned more about lacrosse, when I realized that I loved it and I loved it for the reasons that I thought were great reasons. And I always appreciated that, and I think I always will. It just it makes me feel like, you know, I'm respecting this culture, this tradition, this history of the game and of this region, when it's played the right way, when it's respected in the way that you give it all of your effort and you give it all of your attention, you give it your love. I mean, that's the way it's supposed to be. And so that was one of my instant interests with it. It caused me to want to learn more about the game, but it also, I think it made me feel a little bit unique about it. You know, I don't know if everybody I've ever encountered had that appreciation or had that level of respect for it. And it made me feel like maybe I thought something or knew something that other people didn't know. And, you know, when you're a kid, you always feel like you know things that other people don't know. And it turns out you really don't know that much, but, it was just one of the things that, for me spoke to me, personally. And, when I played the game and the way I competed and I just enjoyed it. You know, it's a game that you're supposed to enjoy. You're supposed to be in a good mindful place, when you're playing and when you're competing. And that, also, it seems like it's still important to me that, you know, if guys aren't enjoying it, if I'm not enjoying it, if it doesn't feel like it's making me better, if I'm not playing it, in the right state of mind, then I don't know if I'm supposed to be there at that time. And I say this to my guys when I coach them, I'm going to enjoy this. I don't need to win to feel like I'm enjoying this. I want to win, and that's always how I'm going to compete, and that's always how I'm going to teach you guys. And I'm also going to teach you that you don't need to win to feel like you're doing this for the value of it. You know, I have a family that makes me feel like I'm winning. I have a life that makes me feel like I'm winning. I get a chance to coach at Hopkins. This makes me feel like I'm doing the right thing. But we're still competing to win here. We're still trying to do this the right way. We're still trying to be, successful and put together the right environment. But enjoy it while you're doing it. I mean, there's a reason that it's a game. You know, I mean, there's a lot of business to it, but my success is determined by the success of, you know, some young men who are playing a game. And so I just want to make sure that they're doing that with the right frame of mind, because if they are, then I think we have a better chance of finding success.
When you think about lacrosse, what are the most important kind of tenets of, I want my team to play this way, from a stylistic standpoint?
You know, that's an interesting question, because it's one of the things that, like, my mom's that proud of me, but she's always said, she's like, I can tell the difference between, like, the way you're coaching certain things, and because she gets the game, but not in the same way that we do, in the same level that we're watching it. But it needs to have a selfless nature to it. It needs to have an approach where, you know, you're going to do whatever is best for your team. If it's going to help Johns Hopkins win and find success, and it's going to be done the right way, then that's a great commitment to the team. And so for me, it's an unselfish approach on the offensive end of the field. You share the ball, you attack directly, you play with some pace, and you try and win the opportunity, each one, whatever it is, but you're doing it the right way. I don't feel like I try and manipulate rules or games or, to me, there's not just an aesthetic, but there's an ethic to it. And I think defensively, it has to have some intensity and some pace. I believe that you're better in most defensive situations when you're dictating and when you're disruptive, rather than when you're just defending. And that's, maybe from my nature, or maybe because by design, I feel like defense needs to be more disruptive than defensive. And so, in the middle of the field, that's usually where we found our success in the past. My coaching career is, when we win the middle of the field, we find success. You know, if we are able to compete from restraining line to restraining line, if we're able to sprint and break down in the same set, in the same couple seconds, if we're able to play strong and fast at the same time, if we're able to play smart and tough at the same time, disciplined, but also, pretty loose. I mean, those are really hard things to do, but in the middle of the field, that's where it's won and lost. I feel like the ends of the field, you can get a little bit more technical and you can get a little more specific. You can rely on one or two players. The middle of the field sometimes just about heart and toughness. And to me, that's always going to be a starter for my degree of success, is if we can win the middle of the field, we can put ourselves a chance. If you lose the middle of the field, you almost never have a chance.
Well, that's a great note to end on. We appreciate your time joining us on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Coach Peter Milliman, congratulations once again on taking over the reins for the Johns Hopkins program, and we look forward to seeing the Blue Jays take the field in the spring of 2021 under your leadership.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.